3, 2, 1.
Are we recording now?
I think we are.
What try is... number two. I don't know. Look. Yeah, we're good. Yeah.
Boom, we're recording. Hey, seems to work. I'm excited. Okay, this is a new step for Still Press. This is the first time that Still Press has recorded outside of boring old Westport, Connecticut. So we're trying something new and live, which is bringing mics on the road. And it took me a little while to figure out the sound stuff. So we're just going to pick up the conversation where we were. Just introduce yourself again, and then we'll go.
So my name is Tachi Imedadze. I am 23 years old, from Tbilisi, Georgia. I got my bachelor's degree in social sciences, and I work full time for the civil movement called SHAME in Georgia. SHAME movement was founded in 2019, following the visit of the Russian Duma member Sergei Gavrilov, which then provoked the Georgian public by addressing the parliament in Russian. And from that day, the SHAME movement has been became the biggest civil movement in Georgia, advocating for democratic reforms, the election reform, justice reform, and many, many social issues, economic issues and stuff. So, yeah, we've been going on for 4 years and still going strong.
Why, basically, is the Russia thing? How do you navigate around that?
I would say that there are two talking points when addressing that question. One is the moral perspective, like the values thing. The thing that we discussed was purely pragmatical, like do you expect this from after, for example, Georgia does this? Mm-hmm. How does Russia respond? Like the economic issues and stuff. So that's the second part of the equation, I would say. The first part is like moral value-based thing.
The Georgia, moral thing seems clear to
me. Georgia has been a part of the whole like Western civilization.
Yes.
From its founding. Like we
2,000 years ago.
Yes.
Like
and the campaign that we're doing, actually, the SHAME movement campaign for this year is called Home to Europe.
Uh-huh.
Saying that, well, it's a home of ours. Currently, we are not there as part of the EU, but, you know, we are the part of this whole civilizational thing. So that's one thing. And on the like more pragmatical side, where you have to weigh up all your decisions to think of some advantages and disadvantages, then there's this point from the Russian propaganda, I would say, that doing anything that is like pro-Western or Georgia or gets Georgia closer to the West, closer to the EU or NATO, is provocative towards Russia. And thus, Georgia should not do such things. That is like, not only that is wrong, that I don't think that Russia has to do anything with Georgia's sovereign decisions, but it also is kind of like doesn't make sense because, for example, Russia is also irritated if we do have an increase in GDP.
Yeah.
Meaning that we are a more successful country than we were the day before. Or if we do, any reform that gets Georgia more advanced than it was.
I totally agree with you.
Thus,
and this is the whole Putin thing that is irritated liberals to no end. But you got a bad neighbor.
Yeah, we know.
In other words, if I think like one thing when I try to explain why people in the United States are the way the United States, mm-hmm. and I'm like, geography really matters.
Of
and
course.
People in the U.S. I don't. Have you spent time in the U.S.?
No, not in the U.S., but I've met many.
Okay, so this is a broad generalization, mm-hmm. for 330 million people, mm-hmm. but I would describe as there's sort of like a naive optimism that things, mm-hmm. can work out. But if you think about the structure of the United States, the neighbors are Canada and Mexico.
Mexico, yeah.
And so the risk of being invaded by anybody seems incredibly distant. And so the psychology here is totally different. And that notion of, I mean, the Russian troops that are occupying a seashore are, what, like 50 kilometers from here?
Yeah, about like 40 minutes drive from Tbilisi.
40 minutes drive from Tbilisi. And you effectively have no defense on them.
Yes.
In other words, they could just roll through.
Yeah.
What I'm stuck on is that I think that any modern, rational person, mm-hmm. is going to want to take steps to make things more transparent here, mm-hmm. and make them more international. And I think that it has the possibility of becoming a huge tourist haven. Because for a lot of Europeans and Americans, and I actually think people in Asia too, you know, traveling to they don't want to go to Azerbaijan. Mm-hmm. Iran is complicated for lots of reasons. Ukraine, there's a war on. So if you want to explore the region, like, Georgia's an unbelievable place, unbelievably hospitable people. People I've met here is, you know, crazy friendly in many mm-hmm. different ways. And that just seems like a national strength. But on the other hand, you're right that Russia is basically unhappy if Georgia succeeds in any way. Yes. And so, but you're a tiny country mm-hmm. and Europe probably doesn't want to have a military here. So mm-hmm. what the hell do you do?
Yeah. So the way I see it, and the way not only I, but the Georgian population generally yep. sees that, is that the only hope for our security in terms of, like, as a state security, is to have as closer ties as possible with the US, with Europe and other members of the NATO. That is solely, like, concerning the security, because basically what happened in 2008, right? We had a war which lasted 5 days. It generally happened in the Ossetia region, in Tsin Valley region, and then the Russian army invaded the country, not only from the Ossetia, but also from Abkhazia. They were bombing basically every city, and the operational decision from our chief of command was to, you know, we are retreating and trying to defend Tbilisi. Mm-hmm. So we were like a day away from the Russians attacking the capital. And what happened? The U.S. Ship just sailed into the Black Sea near the Georgian coast, said that, well, this is a humanitarian mission. But the thing is, the humanitarian mission was led by Miles, the defense secretary. So that's, you know, what happened there.
Right.
So the thing is, what I'm trying to say is that the West and NATO defended Georgia's sovereignty and Georgia, basically, generally. And I hope that they will continue to do that, because that's the, as I was saying, that's the only hope for Georgia to last and outlast this risk of Russia attacking Georgia. Because unless we are not a part of NATO, or unless we don't have the, for example, the US military base here, or some closer ties with the NATO countries and them providing us with the top most modern equipment and technical abilities and stuff, then we cannot defend ourselves against the Russians. Well, the thing is, the funny stuff is that now, after a year of war in Ukraine, their army is so exhausted and so out of resources, like, maybe, of course, jokingly, but we could even fight against them. But of course, they could just right away bomb the capital, like, destroy every strategic object in the country, and then boom, you're finished.
It could be very much like, I think this is before you, but when I was in yeah. graduate school, you know, the war in Yugoslavia was going on, and I was there last summer visiting a lot of these places. I mean, it's vicious what happened there.
Yeah, I was in Belgrade 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Still those, like, destroyed buildings.
And if you go to Sarajevo and you look at, like, the history of mm-hmm. the, you know, the death of the... It's brutal. And so it's a tricky thing, because modernization pushes you in one direction mm-hmm. That increases. It's just levels, because the more degrees you become modern, it actually reduces the risk of this, because you become more integrated. But it's also true that the modernization in other ways increases the risk.
That might be true, because, like, for example, if Georgia decides to be like Belarus, and yeah. we have our own Lukashenko, who says that, well, I'm not going to do anything that will irritate Russia, or even better, like, I'm going to do everything to please Russia, maybe even, like, allow their troops to be like based inside my territory, then yeah, Russia is not going to take away your sovereignty, and there you're going to be called Georgia, but that's only going to be just a puppet show, just like Lukashenko and Belarus is today, sadly. But yeah, that's the case of, like, principles and choices you make as a person, as a society, and as a country. Like, do you want to be independent? Are you a proud nation? Do you want to be on your own, deciding your own fate? Then you have to, you know, fight for it. By fighting, I don't mean exactly fighting. Maybe even that's the thing, but you have to sometimes sacrifice some stuff. And for example, that happened in Ukraine. They saw that.
Yes.
Well,
successfully.
The price that we have to pay for freedom, for Ukraine to be existing, it may be harsh, but there's no other way. We have to fight. And they fought.
I think that one of the things that stunned outsiders about watching Ukraine is the degree of unity. There was not much of it going in, and there's been now a lot of it. You know, shame was invented, if you will, to basically create civil disobedience and Freedom Square, which is right down the street from where we're talking now. How much do you think your perspective is shared throughout Georgia? So I woke up, as you know, early in the morning in a more rural area. Mm-hmm. Very different dynamic there.
Slower life.
It's slower life. And we ran into two people. One of the gentlemen made an argument. We spoke to him in Russian, but made an argument that I've heard in other places, which is basically repeating the propaganda that Russians will say, which is, you know, Ukraine and Russia are long, basically ignoring sovereignty and all these types of things. So how much do you think your guys' views represent sort of like young, smart urban people, educated urban people? And how much do you think they're widespread? And do you think that there's older people who either are nostalgic for the Soviet Union, as strange as it sounds, or believe that small countries should know their place? This is something I heard actually during the invasion. I was in Cyprus, and I remember being at a dinner, and I said, you know, this is like a war crime. And the person at the dinner, it was Cypriot, had the exact opposite. He said, he said the Ukrainians should know their place. Uh-huh. It's like Cyprus can't, you know, throw its weight around. Yeah. It has to look which way which way power is shifting and go with there. So do you think that you guys are representative? And if so, who would disagree with you in Georgia and argue the opposite?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Just a tiny comment on the Cypriot thing.
Yeah.
Basically, that was a random guy who you ran on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, we have a prime minister who thinks like that. He attended the Munich Security Conference, which was in March, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said, and I quote, mm-hmm. I don't interpret here, mm-hmm. I quote. Well, the question was that how do you think the war is going to end in Ukraine?
Yeah.
And his answer was that, well, now Russia, China, EU, and the US must sit down and talk this through to come up with a solution.
Without any Ukrainians, definitely. Yeah.
And then he said that, well, there are big countries, big boys who have to decide the fate of the others. That was basically what he said. And not just to some random media in Georgia, but in the Munich conference, right?
How did Georgians here respond to that?
Badly. But that was the time when this foreign agents law was introduced. So that kind of slipped through.
Uh-huh.
The public would have had a kind of bigger reaction to that. But, you know, we had some other issues to deal with. To get back to your question, I would say that there are two answers to that. First, if you take a look at the polls, the opinion polls, there are almost like it may be decrease a bit and then increase a bit, but mostly about 80% of the population is in support of the European integration and NATO integration.
Right.
That is like a trend that it never goes down like for the past 10 years. And that is what aligns shame movement with the people as well. But you were asking also a more detailed question of it's not solely just saying that, well, I want Georgia to be a part of the EU. That's not enough for people to, you know, cooperate. Yeah, that's a good thing, but, you know, you have to agree on other things as well. I would say that most of the young people, we have not, we don't have any data to, you know, prove this with, but I would say that within my perspective and my experience, I would say that most of the young people and the people who live in the urban areas like in Tbilisi and in other big cities like Batumi, Kutaisi, they are really, really pro-European and pro-Western. And the things that you heard, that you described, are more in the rural areas and mostly inhabited by the older generation. The reason behind that is that, well, first, if you take a look at the demographics of where do Georgians watch Russian TV channels? Mostly it's in the villages.
Yeah.
So these channels, like first channel of like state TV of Russia, Russia 24, RT, others, you know, they are mostly covered in the regions. Like even if we turn on the TV right now, they are here. You could watch that, but in Tbilisi, almost no one does that.
That's interesting.
And if I'm correct, the general number of the population who watches like regularly, for some reason, some day that, well, I watch comedy there, I watch news there, or any other reason, right? There are about like 8 or 9% of the whole population. So I would say that kind of Russian propaganda, the most wild Russian propaganda,
right,
is not that widespread.
Right.
But that's the interesting thing. The danger of Russia being violent and then, I don't know, like maybe we have a conflict with them, that is a more shared fear among the public than the stuff that, you know, Simonian would say. Because that, I explained to myself that, well, it's a normal human reaction to be fearing the war. Because, yeah, I do fear the war. Like, I'm not some Rambo guy, right, who will go there. Of course, it's a natural thing. But then we, like me as a shame movement representative and the guy who has a ambition to be an activist, a public speaker, I feel that it is my responsibility and others as well to explain to people that, well, we don't have any choice. Mm. Like the only choice we have, like there are two ways. One way is that we push ourselves under the carpet, saying, mm-hmm, that, well, of course, Mr. Putin, please come and right, do whatever you want, just like Lukashenko does. Or the other way is that we fight. The fight, of course, again, is not only through our armed conflict. It is also like fighting diplomatically, advancing Georgia's issues on the like international agenda, and basically becoming a good country with democracy, rule of law, and the normal country, the normal stuff that all people like to have inside their countries. So yeah, I think that even if you take a look at the Georgian constitution, we have a point in the constitution that says that, well, Georgia aspires to be a part of the EU and NATO, and the government has to do anything in its power, mm-hmm, to you know, have advancement in that area. So it's like a decision that Georgians made. And it's a firm decision. But still, you know, when you have that kind of a neighbor, which then you have a history of several violent armed conflicts with, then there is always this kind of fear in the back of the head that, well, we have to be careful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also 100, you know, probably they haven't released casualty figures, but,
yeah,
you know, 50,000 dead Ukrainians. I mean, mm-hmm, it's not a small.
Yeah, everyone sees what's going on in Ukraine, yeah, right? There, you have the like fully destroyed cities. You have the people who die there. You have like constant bombings and everything. So yeah, many people kind of channel that on themselves, and they remember, like, they don't even need to, like 10 years ago, like 15 years ago, there was the same thing going on in Georgia,
right,
not in that scale, of course, but
right,
you know. And if you go through the streets and see a person who was born like at least in the year of 2000, right? Like everyone before that has some memory of Russian war.
Yeah.
Like, for example, it was the 2008 war. It was the war in Abkhazia.
Yeah.
Or the first conflict in Tsin Valley in Ossetia, right, region. Or even the older ones have the memory of Soviet regime being like the most cruel regime ever to exist, maybe, like together with the Nazi regime. So we all have this trauma, basically what you were saying, that yes. the Americans, like maybe if I explain this to a fellow, I don't know, someone from Kansas, he or she will be like, okay, but I don't get what you're saying, because they have never experienced that kind of...
It's hard to make it
come to life. Danger and threat. And thus, that's the reason that we have such an ambiguity among the public as well.
Yeah.
That, well, of course, we do want to be a part of NATO, but how do we do this? Like, maybe we should be more careful here or more brave in another thing. Yep. So, yeah, it's a topic of discussion.
For a little bit, Ivan Shvili. He's a mystery character on the outside, mm-hmm. which is, from what I can gather, it's not like in Russia, there's multiple billionaires, there's oligarchs. And the United States, too, has, you know, it has Warren Buffett, course. Bill Gates, and stuff like that.
Koch brothers.
But the Koch brothers, right. But they operate in different fields. Mm-hmm. In Georgia, it seems like there's literally like one super rich guy who is in so many different areas of life. What do you think his strategy is? First of all, who is he? Mm-hmm. And just explain for people who are listening, and what's his strategy?
So Bidzina Ivanishvili, he's 68 or 69 years old. So he's like a Soviet man. He was born in the ruler part of Georgia.
Yeah.
He went to Russia as soon as the Soviet Union collapsed. And he got his wealth basically just like any other oligarch in the wild 90s of Russia. He has his shares in various businesses in Russia. For example, he was a shareholder of Gazprom.
Was he?
Yeah.
He was. Oh, interesting.
Since the beginning of 2000s, he was this mystery figure living in Russia, but always kind of involved in the Georgian life. But like very carefully and very restrictedly. He was kind of doing some charity there or helping a rugby club or a football club. He was doing good things here. And basically, if you just go to the streets in like 2006 in Georgia and ask a random person, do you know who is Ivanishvili? They would say that, well, I don't really know who he is, but I think he's a good guy because he does a lot of good work.
Sounds a little bit like Pablo Escobar in Colombia.
Yes, exactly. So... we didn't know that, and come the year of 2011, he publishes a letter announcing that, well, I am stepping into politics. I'm forming a party. I want to change the power in Georgia, and I want to, you know, have power. And then we find out that his strategy all the way was to buy this social capital in various ways, which then would transform and translate into a political...
How much of a barrier do you think his existence is to Georgia going where you think it needs to go?
Ivanishvili, he does not do the necessary things for Georgia to become the part of EU. If you even look at the candidate status thing, right?
But because he's not elected, do you have any ability to influence
him?
No,
that's the thing. He's the shadow ruler. He does not have any official... position, not even in his own party, take away the state positions. Yeah. Like he was the chair of the party and he resigned in 2020 or 2021, in the beginning of 2021, yes. So he's like officially out of politics. If you look at the stuff that the Georgian media does about that, everywhere you can find his influence, you can find his hands being...
So what is your guy's strategy for dealing with him then?
Ours is that first, I would say he really did well to have this ambiguity around him for the like 9 or 10 years. And then the Ukraine war kind of destroyed that. So I would say that, well, we should not let him to, again, have this robe or a cape of, I don't know, I'm a pro-Western guy, but I am also careful. We should, you know, frame him as a pro-Russian because that's what he is. And not only that it's the truth, but again, this is like pragmatically right for our activistic goals, I would say. That's one thing. And then transparency, democracy, rule of law as much as we can so that he is, he's stuck in such a way that he cannot maneuver his way out of this. Like he, at least he has to, you know, say that, well, if you are such a cool guy and come out and say publicly that, well, I don't want Ukraine to win, or I don't want Russia to lose because such things will happen, blah, 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 what the Russians are saying. Well, instead, he's like hiding in the shadows, not supporting Ukraine. For example, the Ukrainians, we had this information, the Ukrainian embassy said that in spring last year, the Ukrainians asked officially for Georgia to hand out the Buk systems. This is like the air defense systems that we have in our military equipment to be handed out to them because they needed to. And in return, the U.S. would give like more modern versions of or some modern equipment to Georgia. And the reason for that was that, you know, Ukrainians knew how to operate on that systems more effectively rather than new ones. But the Georgian side declined to it. They said that, us giving the equipment to the Ukrainians is that we are participating in a war and we're a
belligerent.
Yeah. So again, we will provoke Russia with that, so we won't do that. They blocked the volunteers from leaving the country. It was in the first week of war, like a lot of Georgians like sent them together. They were actually at the airport. Some Ukrainians, I think it was like the state thing. They sent out the plane to pick those guys up, and then they would fly to Poland and then get to Ukraine. They denied the landing of that plane. They said that, well, we are not going to allow them to go to Ukraine because, again, this is a provocation for Russia. I don't know if you remember, but like a month or month and a half before the war, Russia issued an official statement to the West, to the NATO and EU, saying that, well, in 2008, there was the Bucharest summit of NATO, and there was a decision made that Georgia and Ukraine should eventually become. Right. The Russian side said that, well, we demand that decision to be canceled, and we demand from the West to say that, well, no, Ukraine and Georgia will not become the part of NATO. That was the official statement. And you remember that, and then you hear the prime minister say that, well, Ukraine could not prevent the war. What that means is actually that if, for example, Russia says that, well, I want Georgia to deny its aspiration to be a part of NATO or maybe any other some alliance, I have to prevent the war, right? I have to comply with that demand. So basically he announced surrendering to Russia. He did not say that. He did not explicitly say that, but, you know, you could read that under the lines. So you have these things piling up. You don't have the prime minister or the chair of the party explicitly saying that, well, I don't want Ukraine to win. But you have like so many things just come to my head right now. You have all these things piling up as a person who can rationally think and logically, you know, put some pieces together, say that, well, yeah, they are not in support of Ukraine. Because like, my God, I even remembered one of them saying, one of the high officials of the party saying that, well, let's wait up a bit. The journalist was asking, why are you not more proactive in supporting Ukraine? His response that, well, let's wait what will happen because we don't want to take sides, like officially, because if Russia wins, then, we will have the history of saying that, well, I support Ukraine, then that's a bad thing. So they're actually not sure whether Ukraine is winning, whether Russia is winning, what's going on, what will happen there. And they leave this back route of, for example, if Russia wins, they will just raise their hands and say that, well, don't attack us. We will do anything that you want. Please have this land as yours.
Oh, man, what a mess. You've been super generous with your time.
Yes, that's the thing. And it's all hard to process. I would advise you to, and our listeners as well, to look up some content. The thing is, not that much of a content is translated into English that our local medias do, but I'll try to help you and send you any link or something.
Oh, that'd be great.
That will, you know, get the insights into what's going on currently. And be sure to check our social media pages as well.
Great.
I think it was really, really nice to first to get to know you, to establish a connection, and then get your listeners an insight of what's going on. And I hope if you come back, we could have a chat another time.
Perfect. Thanks, Tom. Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack on paulpodolsky.com and become a paid subscriber. That helps supports the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much. Today's podcast was produced and edited by Dave Manahan.